Show, where I, political analyst and award-winning radio talk show's Tim Kirby, break down issues of the day, current events, geopolitics, and all that from a Russian insider standpoint. And today's guest is Jeff Brown, who has written one heck of a lot of books on China. He is quite passionate on the issue and quite knowledgeable. Because the real big question is China. Is this a, are we living in a project for a new American century? Or is this the century of the dragon? A lot of people are debating, or have been debating, who's going to be the real economic giant of the 21st century. Then again, from inside Russia, we could have a multipolar world where there's a few different economic giants that sort of fill different niches and work in symbiosis, but that's all very, very Russia there. Let's first, before we get to the interview with Mr. Brown, let's have a little bit of chit-chat about the relationship between Russia and China. Now, recently, Putin said after a teleconference with Xi something to the effect that Russia and China have this amazing relationship, the best relationship in history, as I think the way he put it, which sounded kind of, I don't know, lame. I guess because I'm an American, I'm very cynical about any sort of this glorification or what some might infer to be a little bit of butt-kissing. But when I sat down to kind of think about it and got over my American instincts there, Putin kind of made a good point. There is something very unique and special about the relationship between Russia and China. First off, we can't forget that Russia and China, in terms of each other, are both political actors. Because you could say the relationship between Romania and Moscow during the Cold War were fantastic because Romania didn't have much choice, did it? Or North Korea and Moscow or whatever during the Cold War, right? So if you have a sort of master-vassal relationship, of course the relations are always good, because they have to be. The vassal has no choice but to say that they're good or try to believe that they're good, right? And Russia and China are not, there's no master-vassal side of things, so essentially they both have the freedom to dislike each other, and the freedom and the ability to do bad things to each other, and yet they don't, okay? That's very important, and it makes sort of the pernicious nature of the United States stand out even more, because the United States does have the power to do bad things to other actors on the global stage, but they tend to do that a lot more often. Another thing that's important to understand is that as these two major players on the globe, Russia and China have really managed to work together and yet stay out of each other's business. That's also a very important aspect, because if we're going to build a multipolar world, there's of course going to be conflicts. There's always going to be some sort of piece of territory that's people are fighting over. There's always going to be some weird border that no one likes, or some sort of different ethnic groups that are divided by something. There's always going to be some reason to have some sort of spats. But I think Russia and China have really, what they've really done is their relationship is the model for the relationship between the different poles of the multipolar world as it arises. It's based on fulfilling obligations. It is based on working together against anyone who is on the monopolar world side. Because remember, you know, one thing Western-style democracies do very well is when other systems tend to be against them, Western-style democracies always stick together. And so I think the multipolar world order has to essentially always stick together when dealing with someone advocating for a different, the only other option being the monopolar world order. So that's very important. And Russia and China have done that very well. And again, the important thing to understand is this this partnership between Russia and China is also very unique in the fact that it's not some sort of mutually exclusive partnership. Just because Russia and China are in the SCO and they're really working together on this Belt and Road Initiative stuff and they're both in the multipolar world and all that, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to exclude then interaction with other countries, right? So I think in a lot of alliances in the past have sort of divided people into completely separate camps, whereas this interaction between Russia and China really doesn't. You know, Russia has the ability to sort of work with the Philippines, and I know the Philippines tends to have a stressful relationship with China. China also has kind of a stressful relationship with India on some level. Russia can also work with them. Russia or China's also continues to be really America's factory, and we all know U.S. and Russian relations are terrible. But overall, I think it's this flexibility, this understanding that everyone has their own interests, everyone wants to survive, we have to be a little bit It's almost like Christian ethics. We have to be a little bit tolerant of people, give someone a break because they have their own sort of interests at heart, and build the relationship to the best of our ability, with not to the detriment of the people in the relationship. So, in a lot of ways, what Putin said about this U.S. So in a lot of ways, what Putin said about the Chinese-Russian relationship being something truly unique and special and the best in history, he might have been telling the truth. But anyways, let's hear about this all from Jeff Brown, who is an author of multiple books on China and a man who is certainly passionate about the future of that big nation. So, Mr. Brown, you've written many books about China, a trilogy, in fact. So, could you tell us why are you so enthralled by this nation?
My wife and I, well, first off, I lived in Africa in the Middle East for 10 years before. Then my wife and I moved to China from 1990 to 1997. And we then came back to Europe and the United States, moved back to China in 2010. And both of us were so gobsmacked at by what we saw. I mean, not just the infrastructure and the development, but the change in the people and the change in their attitudes, it was just a radical transformation. And it inspired me to, and we were in Beijing, and I said, you know, I got to get out into the countryside to see if these changes have been made in the rest of the country. And so that's, I took off and went to the six poorest provinces in China, including the Tibetan Plateau. And I was even more gobsmacked. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And when I came back, I thought I was going to do a blog, and it ended up being my first book, 44 Days Backpacking in China. That inspired me to keep writing about China. I didn't stop. And so then I end up writing the China trilogy, China Rising, and then the Big Red Book on China. I continue to write about China. I say it's the greatest show on earth, and I think that's true.
All right, so over that time period, what specific things have changed?
The big difference was that in the 1990s, that was what I used to call the Deng Xiaoping Wild East Buckaroo days. And that was when, after Mao died, and starting in 1978, Deng kind of unleashed the dogs of capitalism, on, but not at the macro level, at the consumer level. They still had control of the 100 basic industries. They still had control of all the land and major industries, heavy industries, infrastructure. But on the street level, it was intoxicating in a bad way. I mean, it was absolutely unhinged, jungle capitalism. And so it was rough. I mean, it was, I worked there, we worked and lived and worked there for 7 years, and it was exhausting, but it was almost like a drug addiction. It was so intense, you just couldn't get in. It was like a five pack a day nicotine habit. And so we left. And so when we came back, the people were like so much, they had gone through so many changes. They were so much more, all that, all that had gone by the wayside, all the unhinged, street level capitalism that had was going on was basically toned down dramatically with the 2008 Olympics. And it was like, wow. And not only that, but I mean, it was just like, the infrastructure was better, than what we were living in, and than what we were living in Oklahoma the previous 10 years in the United States. So it was just everything. The attitude, the mentality of the people doing business, working there, living there, it was just much more relaxing and much more enjoyable than in the early 90s.
You just mentioned mentality, which is a huge part of this program, this YouTube channel, everything I write. I believe mentality is always a critical issue to discuss. Mentality and ideology, which are kind of similar. But anyways, so the question is, how has the mentality of a Chinese person in, say, the 1990s, you know, how has that changed from then till now? How does a modern Chinese person think in comparison to his 1990s counterpart?
Well, in the 1990s, because the, you know, the dogs of capitalism at the street level, this is what's so strange, they still maintained finance, insurance, real estate. They still had the 100 largest, you know, industries under state-owned enterprises. But at the commercial level, the street level, it was dog eat dog. And people were, you know, lying and cheating. And there was no one could trust anybody because it was all about making money. It was all about the big hustle. I'm not saying everybody, but too many. And their crime was a problem compared to now today. You know, there's almost none other than financial crime and online crime. But I mean, I'm just, you know, there were people, you know, putting bars on their windows, and it was like living in the Wild West, and it was you against the local world, and it was just, I mean, it was fun and it was exciting, and but it was not a healthy experience, and not good for the soul. And so when we came back, it was like, that was the difference. And so then during that time, the Chinese people started to go back to their Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism, which are three distinct belief systems. But over the millennia, they've melded into sort of a universal belief system, and most Chinese don't distinguish between the three. You'll find specialists in each one, but most of them don't. And so it was just, you know, there was a lot more spirituality. There was you could trust people. You could, you know, you could worry about not being ripped off. It was, you know, there the security on the street was back. Honesty in business was much more prevalent, and it got more and more so, especially with Xi Jinping when he became president in 2012, 2013, and general secretary of the Communist Party of China. And he has kicked ass and taken names and cleaned up the party. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people, are going to jail or have been kicked out. And also in business, because they have the social credit system, which is aimed mainly at reining in corrupt and corrupt businesses and corporations to make them accountable to the public. I know this. So that's the difference.
Okay. So here's a big one, but I think it's very important. So how is this whole Confucian revival, going back to Chinese traditions, I mean, how is that really playing out in China? Is this just some sort of empty government nationalism to sort of placate the population? Or is there something to this? Because generally, most of the communists, when they came into power, they wanted to get rid of the past. The past didn't work for them. So it's kind of weird to hear that the Chinese Communist Party Marxists are now embracing the glory of the past, the glory of a very non-Marxist past.
The one of the big canards in Western media and propaganda is that the Chinese, the Communist Party of China, the CPC, has to justify itself. It does not have to justify itself. The people love the CPC. They demand the CPC. And what is so interesting, as I have pointed out in my writings, is that China has basically been a communist civilization and society going back 3,500 years ago to the Shang Dynasty, the first great dynasty. And so there's no need to justify it. And Marxism, with its dialectics and its lack of, God and Godhead et cetera, jives very nicely with, although Confucius, they believed in gods back then, but Buddhism is essentially an atheistic religion, although they add the kitchen god and the fertility god and the money god and the house god and the temple god, but it's essentially an atheistic religion. There's no god in pure Buddhism. So it just, when China became communist back in the 1930s and 40s, it was perfectly normal for the Chinese because it had been more or less like that for thousands and thousands of years. Polls show, and not Chinese polls, but Pew and other polling companies, international polling companies, show that the Chinese have the highest level of satisfaction with their government in the world, something like 85%. So, and their press, they have 65 or 70% satisfaction with their media, which is government managed and controlled. So that's one of the canards that needs to be put off right away, is that the Chinese communists are desperately trying to stay in power. No, that's not true.
Well, one counter argument to what you're saying would be that maybe there's a culture of fear that really affects official answers to official questions, just like the kind that's spread across American universities.
It's not true. That was not true during the time of Mao. I can tell you that the Chinese, and I write about this a lot, Chinese democracy is much more consensual, is much more consultative than anything the West has ever been able to offer, except maybe the Greeks back, 750 years before, or 500 years before Christ, when they had about 100 or 150 years of a direct democracy. There is a fundamental idea that needs to be understood. The Chinese do not think it is constructive to go hold up a poster on Tiananmen Square and say, "I think Xi Jinping is a jerk," or, "I think he's a bad leader." Because that, in Chinese culture, is a loss of face, not only for the rulers, the government, but also for the people. However, you want to go and complain about the government? You want to go and complain about corruption? You want to go complain about Xi? You want to go complain about this and that and this and that? The CPC and the Chinese government are the largest polling organization in the world. They do millions of polls every year, trying to find to learn the zeitgeist of the population. Mao did it, and it was called the mass line. Listen to the people, and then do what they want, answer the needs of the people. So I can tell you right now, I mean, I've seen demonstrate there are 200 to 300 protests a day in China. And as long as it's not personal, as long as it's not ad hominem, if they want to complain about this company or this, the fact that the department, that this ministry is not doing its job, or, what about this pollution here? Or why is our sewage systems a mess? There are hundreds of protests every day in China. And the Chinese government is sitting there writing all this down because they want to find out what's going on. And if there's a corrupt guy or a corrupt gal involved, they want to get rid of that guy and gal. And if they're in the party, get him out of the party. So I'm sorry, it's so hard, Tim. It is so hard to get Westerners to unload all these shibboleths that they have about communism, socialism, Mao, the Great Leap Forward, the Cultural Revolution, dictatorship, lack of democracy, lack of expression. There right now, I can go online in China, And there are anti-Mao groups. There are pro-Mao groups. There are anti-Xi groups. There are anti-Mao groups. There are anti-CPC groups. There are pro-PC groups. And you can vent yourself all you want, and you can also go down to your local, if you don't want to go to one of the, and I used to see all these, when we were living there, we used to see all these polls that, please come in, we want to talk to you about this. Please come in, we want to talk to you about that. But if you've got a bug up your butt, you can go down to your local village committee or neighborhood committee and vent your spleen. And I can promise you that that is going to go up at least one level if it's considered to be noteworthy.
Yeah, in Russia, criticism of the government that doesn't really mention specific people has always gone over better, especially in the USSR. But anyways, you've already mentioned Mao a few times. Now, in Russia, if we were to go outside and ask people about the legacy of Vladimir Lenin, there'd be a lot of different versions. We would hear high praise and scathing criticism at the same time. So, how does the Chinese public today, overall, in general, view the legacy of Mao? And does that general view strongly differ from what's written in official public school textbooks?
Well, on the street level, I would say that Mao is more popular than he is officially. I always tell people, never forget that 95% of the Chinese people agree. They may not like Mao, or they may not like some of the things that Mao did, but they agree with his world view. And the world view is that global capitalism is the enemy, and socialism and communism are the only way to survive against that global capitalism, and which of course entails imperialism, and serve the people. Serve the people. We exist to serve the people. And so he is incredibly popular. I mean, and you'll find people who don't like him. You'll find concern, anti-Maoist. But I've been to his hometown. I mean, there are more people that visit his hometown in China every year than do than do all the Disneylands and the Disney worlds of the across the planet. He's incredibly popular. Just a case in point, Zheng Zhengfei, the founder of Huawei, the major behemoth ICT company that the United States is trying to destroy, calls Mao his inspiration. He sends out Mao Zedong speeches and texts, to 200,000 employees. Mao's Little Red Book is used by millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of Chinese, even today, as a source of inspiration to solve problems, etc. So he, I mean, there's parades all the time when on his death anniversary, his birth anniversary, etc. So officially, he, according to the Deng, the Deng Commission that came out after he died, he was 70% correct and 30% incorrect, which is interesting because Mao actually used those same percentages in the Little Red Book about, well, if somebody does 70% right, that's good enough, and only 30% wrong is good enough. So they said he was 70% right and 30% wrong, and that was basically because of the Cultural Revolution. Although there are many people that do not agree with that. There are many people who support the Cultural Revolution and what happened with it.
Okay, so if Mao said that the big mission is to fight global capitalist imperialism or something of the like, well, what does that mean in terms of countries, and friendly countries like Russia or Iran? I mean, Russia is capitalist now, some would say state capitalist, but definitely not communist, right? And Iran is and had an Islamic revolution, and they are not communist, and they are almost a theocracy. So, is China's willingness to work with Russia and Iran, is this just some sort of like new Ribbentrop-Molotov pact, or is there a different dynamic to things? So, how does this mission laid out by Mao affect the rest of the world outside of the Golden Billion?
Rahman Mazaharian, Iranian American, he would disagree with you. Iran is, he said the Ayatollah, they had lots and lots of discussions at the street level and at the policy level. And it was, are we going to be Islamic first and socialist second, or socialist first and Islamic second? And they decided to go with socialism first and Islam second. Many people consider Iran to be very, very socialist. They nationalized, many industries. So, but that's a whole nother story. But I do think they are socialist. Russia, I'd love to have you on my show one day to tell me, but obviously I call them CSAI countries, communist, socialist, anti-imperialist, and Russia is definitely anti-imperialist. And I understand there's still quite a bit of, socialism in the education, medicine, et cetera. I don't know. We'll talk about that when I have you on my show. We're talking about Wall Street capitalism. We're talking about robber baron capitalism. We're talking about crony capitalism. We're talking about monopoly capitalism. That's what Mao was talking about. We're talking about, using the sanctions and the boycotts and the blockades and the fines and the illegal arrests and the piracy of ships and around the world, like they do with the weaker countries like Venezuela and North Korea. That's what Mao is talking about. And I don't think Russia is anywhere near that, and nor is Iran at all.
Putin recently said something to the effect that Russia and China have one of the greatest relationships ever between two nations, two powerful nations anyways. So does Xi say the same thing within China? What is sort of the word on the street in terms of that? Is there something really, truly amazing being born between Russia and China, or was this all just some political butt kissing?
Well, I think that's a good question, Tim. I think both Putin and Xi are very cognizant of the Sino-Soviet split in 1959-1960. I think there are a lot of Russian historians and Chinese historians that consider that to be one of the most tragic events in the 20th century. And that the world would be much, much, much different today if they had not split and had stayed together as comrades in arms. It is true that Mao is the one that broke it off because he considered Khrushchev to be a turncoat to his people and to the socialist revolution. So he did break it off, and at great cost, because it happened right during the Great Leap Forward, when there was a 200-year drought and 200-year floods. So it caused a lot of problems. And the fact that the Sino-Soviet split was inspired by America, and to use China against the Soviet Union. And so I think they realized that that was a huge, huge mistake, and that they have much more to offer the world and their respective peoples working together than as competitors. And so thankfully, since the 1990s, they have resolved all of their border disputes. The amount of commerce is staggering. I had Russians in China. I had lots of Russian friends doing business there. Bridges are being built. Bridges are being built across the Amur River. Russia and China work together to make sure that the DPRK, North Korea, does not get taken down by NATO, especially the United States. I would be so worried if China and Russia were not working together hand in hand today, because NATO, global capitalism, Europe, the United States, Canada, the Five Eyes are so deranged and so totally out of control that the only thing we have saving us is their cooperation. And it's sincere. I mean, I've read in the Chinese press that Putin and Xi genuinely like each other. They genuinely respect each other. And they both believe in a multipolar world. I think Russians and Chinese generally believe in a, well, you can tell. I'll let you do talk for Russia. The Chinese believe in a multipolar world, and they believe in win-win, and they believe in mutual benefit. And so that's what China and Russia have right now. And thank God, because if Russia was still the way it was, in 1990, what kind of a mess would this world be in? So this is not polishing apples or, make feel good rhetoric. They like each other. The Chinese like Russians. I used to talk to him. We left in 2019 to retire, and but up until the time I left, the Chinese admire and like the Russians. They have absolutely nothing in common, really, culturally, and their comportment's different, et cetera. But they genuinely like the Russians, and lots of Russians were coming to China before COVID, and lots of Chinese were going to Russia before COVID. So I let's hope that Russia and China can continue their cultural, strategic, tactical, geopolitical, military, technological, education, infrastructural cooperation, because it's not only good for them, it's also good for all of us outside of those two countries.